Hello, and welcome to Databook, a healthcare analytics news podcast. I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles. Today we're kicking things off with a cautionary tale, a word of warning.
So the year is 1996. The date is January 22nd. And the world? Well, that's about to change.
This is the day that the New York Times website goes live for the very first time.
It's a big deal. The Times is the paper of record, and this whole internet thing is still young. Some people think it's a flash in the pan. It's just a trend.
But the New York Times knows better than that, or at least their leaders know better.
So they go online with the goal of increasing readership and exploring whatever opportunities might live in so-called cyberspace. And what do they call this website? This electronic publication?
It's a catchy one. It's called The New York Times on the Web.
So catchy.
The newspaper's own journalists cover the launch of the website, and the story appears in print and online.
So right about now, you might be wondering, why is Databook diving into this story about a newspaper and its website? What does the newspaper business have to do with healthcare?
It's pretty simple. Journalism in the 90s and early 2000s was at this huge, never-before-seen crossroads. New technologies were emerging every day out of the woodwork, and the way things always had been was all of a sudden changing.
So the newspaper industry's only chance to survive was to keep up with these trends. But that was not easy.
First of all, nobody knew what exactly was going to work. No one knew how to make the internet work for journalism. But there was another problem, too. A lot of these institutions and plenty of people, editors, reporters, and salespeople, they actively resisted these changes. They were fighting against the future.
And as it turns out, a similar form of cultural resistance is gripping healthcare at this very moment. In some ways, the stakes aren't as dire. Healthcare isn't going anywhere. But in other ways, adaptation is a matter of life and death.
So after the Times goes digital, a lot of other big names follow in its footsteps. The Wall Street Journal started publishing online just a few months later.
And yeah, some news organizations embraced the internet before the Times did. But the point here is that the Times and the Journal, they were kind of like your Mayo Clinics, your Kaiser Permanentes. They still faced some internal resistance to tech and the internet, but they were the brightest and the best in their business.
And that's exactly what makes these ivory tower publications much more able and definitely more willing to innovate than smaller regional newspapers. Many of those news outlets didn't go digital until several years down the road, and a lot of them went out of business or got eaten up by major newspaper chains before then.
And what about the journalists themselves? The people who reported and wrote and put out the papers every day?
A lot of those people aren't journalists anymore.
Poof. Gone into early retirements, public relations, academia, and wherever else ink-stained wretches went to find a new home.
Now, this is not to say that cultural resistance alone caused all of journalism's problems.
Of course not.
It was really a perfect storm of evolving technologies and business models, wilting revenue sources, and a consolidating market. But the changing role of the reporter definitely threw off plenty of people.
Caught him off guard. And as journalists, this is something that Tom and I, your co-hosts, know firsthand. We actually met when we were working for a small group of weekly newspapers in New Jersey. This was maybe around 2012.
Around that time, the internet had already changed the news business. It had also changed what was expected of reporters. And it had changed what type of content newspapers were publishing.
Put it this way, the reporters who used to have our jobs, maybe in the 90s or 80s, they would have been responsible only for reporting and writing stories. That was it.
But times had changed. By the time that we entered the newsroom, we were shooting video, taking photos, posting on social media platforms, you name it, we were doing it.
Not to toot our own horns. But eventually, we both left. And those newspapers, they're still around today, but they did get bought by another company.
Jack and I moved on to jobs that required even more adaptation from their journalists. all of a sudden, analytics were a big deal. Page views, time on site, social referrals, all these things became a measure of a reporter's performance.
Fairly or unfairly. But they also became a reporter's tool. For the first time, journalists could see which stories worked and which flopped. We could do A/B testing with headlines. We could even use social media to search for stories and report them.
Now, that's not to say that all of this stuff was voluntary. Journalists had to cut video. We had to pay attention to page views. We had to update our writing style and tone for the web.
We had to adapt.
The recent history of news is filled with the tales of the publications and journalists that didn't adapt.
And they don't get to write that city council story anymore. They don't get to cover what's going on in the state house. Instead, in many cases, their very demise became the story that other people were writing.
And it's becoming more apparent every day that healthcare is going through a similar sort of consolidation.
For sure. The institutions that don't use data and analytics to up their game and improve outcomes, they won't be around forever.
And to take that a step further, the doctors who don't want to use new high-tech tools, the ones who don't want their performance to be judged by data, they might stick around, but they are contributing to the lag in medicine's evolution.
Because the truth is, big data and AI and tech, all of these things might be able to improve healthcare for the better. But they're only effective if clinicians use them and use them properly.
So what can we do to convince doctors that these tools are really worth using? How can healthcare crush the cultural resistance?
So to take a look at the cultural resistance facing health tech and how innovation can overcome it, we brought on Dr. Kevin Campbell. He's a cardiologist and a big advocate for tech in medicine, but he also pushes for physicians and clinicians to be represented in this new wave, to be the driving thought behind these technologies.
You might know Kevin from TV or his online writing and video work. He's a really big media personality, but he also runs the startup Pacemate. It's a digital health company that specializes in data sharing between medical devices and doctors. It helps information reach clinicians at the point of care.
And best of all, Dr. Campbell is a member of our editorial advisory board, Healthcare Analytics News. So thanks for being here and welcome to Databook, Kevin.
Well, thank you guys for having me today. I think that this is one of, in my opinion, one of the most important topics in medicine. It's so very relevant to what's going on in today's healthcare world.
All right. So to get started, can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen in terms of cultural resistance to tech and data in healthcare? What sort of stories do you have for us?
It's interesting. As physicians, we are always innovating and want the, particularly in my world of cardiology and electrophysiology, we all want the latest and greatest tools and tricks and new technologies to treat our patients. Yet when it comes to accepting some of this digital platform as a way to communicate with patients or a way to analyze data or big data, I think we're a little resistant. One of my mentors, Dr. Eric Topol from Scripps, has said many, many times that, you know, you have technology and data and digital and all of these things are separated from medicine and clinicians because we sort of move around in separate but parallel orbit. And what that does is that it keeps us from innovating using those tools as physicians. You know, in terms of stories that I have, I think that there's so many times that doctors are so focused on large randomized controlled clinical trials, which are good things and help us understand how best to care for our patients. But these often take years to accomplish. They are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to perform, when in reality, we might could get very similar answers to very important questions in real time by embracing big data and using technologies such as AI and machine learning and deep learning. And these types of tools are going to change the way we practice medicine. But right now, there's this huge resistance. We have to have this big paper presented at the American College of Cardiology. We have to have this big data set presented in order to adapt it. And honestly, by the time a lot of these trials are done, what we figured out is already obsolete because the next trial is underway.
Being on this beat, I hear about this problem all the time. And I'm curious, is it really as big of a problem as it seems to be? Is there any way to quantify this or to take a look at just how pervasive it is?
Well, I think it's a huge problem. I'll give you a perfect example. Just in the last month, one of the leaders in the field of heart failure, Dr. Milton Packer, and everyone has a great respect for him. He's an older gentleman who wrote many of the seminal papers on the way we treat patients with congestive heart failure and coronary artery disease. He wrote an editorial about how Twitter was the wrong venue for people to be discussing medicine and discussing trials and debating these things. And that right there is the issue. Milton Packer's not on Twitter. Milton Packer has never been on Twitter. The problem is these older guys, the old guard, who we have great respect for, feel threatened because they can no longer control the message. When a trial comes out, the only voices you used to hear were the gray-haired guys on the podium or the guys who were on the editorial board for Circulation or the Journal of American College of Cardiology. Now, every voice can be heard in this social and digital space. Everyone can review this paper critically. Everyone can be part of the analysis and the peer review as opposed to an appointed editorial board for a journal. So I think that this type of resistance is real. And I think some of it is because of ignorance by the old guard of the beauty and the power of social media. Some of it is fear of actually losing that ability to control the academic message. And honestly, some of it is just the fact that they're unwilling to move forward with technology. All of the societies, the Heart Rhythm Society, the American College of Cardiology, we're all moving into the digital age and starting to create decision tools that are applications on your phone that can help you move through the guidelines that way. So I think it is a big problem. I think we're 10 years behind where we should be in developing these technologies, and it's because of this resistance from the guys who have always been the leaders of the societies and the academic thought leaders.
So what can healthcare executives do to create an environment where innovation is welcome and championed?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't think it's a simple answer. However, I do believe that moving towards automation in tasks in a healthcare facility, such as the remote monitoring of implanted devices like we do at PaceMate, rather than have that done manually by, you know, 6 or 7 nurses to follow 7,000 devices, and always, even in my institution, we were 3 to 6 months behind on that paperwork, embrace automation where we can use artificial intelligence, machine learning to actually automate much of that process, still have the human touch involved with clinicians overlooking and overseeing this process, rewarding innovation within a healthcare system, creating, for instance, a competition at your institution to create an application to improve compliance with medications, or maybe an application to improve follow-up attendance at visits. There's lots of ways to do this, but you need a visionary executive in the healthcare space. Human beings and doctors and nurses and healthcare providers are very smart. Machines can make us smarter if we use them properly.
Now let's talk a little bit more about that. How about these tech innovators and these people developing the software and devices that clinicians are responsible for using? What can they really do to get clinicians on board?
You know, I think the key is you have to bring all players to the table. You have to have clinicians and patients and administrators and the guys who count the numbers on the balance sheet all at the same table. We have to list what are real world problems at our institutions that we want to solve. Maybe it's recurrent admissions for congestive heart failure. Maybe it is missed follow-up appointments. Maybe it's a lack of compliance with medications. What are real world problems? And then we talk about how do we solve them now? And then we need to think creatively, what are some new ways that we can solve them? And maybe the developers can say, well, instead of making phone calls, we can create an application. If we can show clinicians that we can improve your workflow, decrease the amount of work you have to do within an EMR, and increase your productivity and increase your patient outcomes, as well as, you know, medicine is a business, monetize the work you do in a more efficient way, it's a no-brainer. The sky's the limit. Now is the time, but we need young, forward-thinking clinicians. You know, I consider myself to be part of that group, and that's what we need, combining all the smart things that we see coming out of Silicon Valley and other very innovative areas across our country.
Now, Kevin, we know that it's key to get clinicians on board when we're rolling out any new technologies. Is it fair to say that any clinicians who aren't adopting this tech are setting things back? Who's really at fault here?
You know, I think it's across the board. A lot of clinicians do want this, but I think they are scared of this. I think, why are you scared? We're always scared of the unknown. Physicians take a much longer time to accept radical change. And that, I think, may be for several reasons. One, we're a very litigious society when it comes to medical legal affairs. Number two, we know that, you know, the people who trained us only did it this way, and we respect the folks who trained us at Duke or wherever. And when we see an opportunity to do something different that strays from the way we were taught to do things, it takes a long time to accept that. But, you know, what we really have to do is make sure that clinicians are incentivized to be innovators. And I think that also comes from the management side of things, because no longer is it clinicians run the hospital, clinicians run the business side of medicine. Clinicians are employees now, and that's been really hard to swallow for many of us. And one of the things that comes with being an employee is this feeling of, I am hopeless, helpless. I cannot affect change. So I'll just do what I have to do. I'll punch the clock every day. So maybe by incentivizing clinicians to develop these types of technologies and embrace these technologies. And here at Pacemate, we're trying to at least show some really nice data that shows that what we're doing really works and really makes an impact on what doctors care about, which is outcome. And, you know, in fact, I'll be presenting 3 papers at the Heart Rhythm Society on how our system has improved outcome. And if we can do those types of research studies that are really not very difficult to do when you have a large database of patients and you have a good statistician and you ask the right questions, I think that that will hopefully increase adoption.
Kevin, you are one of the tech-centric, social media savvy, kind of forward-thinking physicians out there. What path did you take to become such an adopter of tech and healthcare? Was there a specific moment in your story?
You know, I've always kind of been a serial entrepreneur. I've always wanted to think of better ways to do things. But yes, a lot of this, particularly when it comes to the media side of things, comes with a lot of luck and being in the right place at the right time, and also making the most of your opportunities, as it is with any business. I got my break into the media, but I was in the EP lab doing a case where I was implanting a defibrillator in a patient who had suffered sudden cardiac death and been revived. And in the national news that day, a prominent basketball coach, NCAA basketball coach, had had sudden cardiac death and unfortunately was not able to be resuscitated. So the PR folks from my hospital came around and asked, when I was making rounds that afternoon, if I would be willing to speak to the media about sudden death. And I did. And I was under the impression that this was going to be on the local CBS affiliate. As it turned out, it was on the CBS Evening News. And that was sort of my big break in the media. And after that, folks started coming to me, anywhere from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal to CNN or Fox or MSNBC or CBS or whoever. And I was able to really develop a digital as well as a media brand. And once you develop that brand, I was able to use that brand to give me the opportunity to explore lots of other technology. And also, it gave me the opportunity to rub shoulders with some of the leaders in the technology field and really become inspired by them. You just have to, eyes wide open, always be flexible, be willing to reinvent yourself. And when you get an opportunity, always make the most of that opportunity.
Now, Kevin, we know that there are a lot of opportunities for growth and development here. Who's doing it right? Who can we look to as the adoption role models?
Well, my role model is Dr. Eric Topol at Scripps. I've known Eric since I was a resident at the University of Virginia when he recruited me to Cleveland Clinic. And he is just an amazing person. He is of the belief that we want to digitize the human being, which is exactly what I want to do. He believes that it is no longer acceptable to use population studies like these big clinical trials to help us understand how to treat you and me and my mom and your mom and any other patient in the world. We need to use those population studies to help guide therapy, but personalized data is where it's at. We should all have our genetic code on our smartphone. We should personalize your antibiotics or whatever treatment you need for cancer based on your genetic code. And that, I think, is a really great example. Dr. Topol, you know, has been a big proponent of using wearable technology. Also, you know, to monitor EKG, heart rate, what have you. There's also, you know, portable ultrasound machines rather than going and getting an echocardiogram with a big machine that costs $10,000 and a cost of $600 to the patient. What's wrong with using a pocket probe just to get a quick answer and make a quick clinical decision? I think another example, one of my good friends, Dr. David Albert, who graduated the program at Duke many years before I did, and he'll laugh because I'm calling him old now, invented something called AliveCor, which is an electrode that we can trace a very, very robust electrocardiogram from your fingertips by using an electrode that's Bluetooth connected to your phone. Now we can also use that same technology on a band attached to your iPhone or to your Apple Watch, so that you can actually have a continuous ECG on your watch. These types of technologies are amazing.
Dr. Kevin Campbell, everybody. He is the CEO of Pacemate, the health data startup, and so much more, including an editorial advisory board member for our magazine, Healthcare Analytics News. To find out more about him, check him out on Twitter at Dr. Kevin Campbell. Doc, thank you so much for stopping by Databook.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I think this is a really, really important message that everyone, whether you're a doctor, administrator, patient, should hear. Let's all work together and let's push everyone that's in a position to make decisions, whether it's at a government level, whether it's at the policy level, whether it's at the hospital or clinic level. Let's push everyone to open their eyes to how technology is going to absolutely change the way we practice medicine in the next decade.
So it's pretty clear that physicians have a ton on their plates these days. Before we say goodbye, Databook is going to examine that issue a little bit and the role that tech plays or doesn't play.
Janae Sharp is going to deliver this week's edition of The Insight. She's an advocate who lost her husband, a physician, to suicide. Ever since, she's been tracking clinician burnout and trying to help the helpers.
Janae, why don't you take it away?
I'm Janae Sharp, and I recently founded the Sharp Index, and I am a physician suicide loss survivor. Part of my background is that, separate from my personal story, I've worked in health IT, creating data products and creating better workflow to help gain insights for social determinants of health, because increasingly, physicians find themselves responsible for delivering great health outcomes and helping patients, but they don't necessarily have the tools necessary to do so. More and more, the role of a physician is changing and it has more burden. And there are technologies that can help with that and there are tools, but there's a disconnect between those expectations and the new requirements, increasing regulatory burden, and the actualities of delivering care. And throughout John's experience, he started showing signs of stress, like huge stress, and wasn't able to cope with that. And then ended up dying by suicide after the school tried to help and people really tried to support him. The reaction when someone dies that way is so different than when someone dies from a tragic death, an accident, or a disease like cancer. And I was so frustrated. I got more involved in physician burnout and suicide after John died. So they're working a number of hours that most people wouldn't want to work. And they're also working in high stress environments. So as I've talked to people about burnout and kind of tried to get more feedback from physicians about how they point to the EHR as a source of frustration, even though I didn't think it was the reason that my former husband passed away, it is a huge problem. Part of that you can see in the number of hours that physicians are actually working. According to some records, 52% of their day is spent in the EHR. 1.4 of those hours are actually during personal time. We've looked at the data in an electronic health record, really can show you how often physicians are in the electronic health record making notes and catching up on that. It's not tenable with having a healthy lifestyle. So if you've worked a 12-hour shift, which many of them are working 24-hour shifts, then you're going to go home and take notes for several hours after that in order to, you know, meet the billing standards. Only 32 or 33% of your time is spent giving actual medical care. It's interesting that providers in America point to the electronic health record and those recording as part of one of the huge factors for them being burned out. Some of them, if you think about each encounter, you might need to fill out paperwork to make sure you're meeting your requirements for good standards of care or billing standards. You might be filling out paperwork for 45 minutes with each encounter. First of all, that's way too much time. It's just an inefficient system. The increased regulatory burden that we've placed on physicians is showing itself and our electronic health record because that's our billing engine. So they feel like cogs in a wheel. That separation from what we know about healing, from being with people, it is killing our physicians. And our tech isn't serving us in the way that it should have been designed to do.
So that's it for this episode of Databook.
Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review.
And check out Healthcare Analytics News online at hcanews.com.
We promise to bring you the best coverage in health IT all day, every day.
Until next week, take care.
Bye.